Goddard Reel 13. The next period we're going to consider is your short period working with North Sea type airships, which began at Kingsnorth in the autumn of 1917. Now, the North Sea types were, as you've told me already, considerably larger. Could you give me an appreciation of the complexity of the way they function by perhaps relating the various aspects of the crew's work?
Well, the North Sea ship was a streamlined Astrotaurus type with two cars slung instead of one car slung underneath the body, fairly close to the body of the envelope. The forward of those two cars was the bigger, and it contained several compartments in a girder-braced fuselage or girder-braced fabric-covered construction. In the forward part, behind glass, and the whole thing was covered in, but only by fabric and glass, there were two coxswains instead of one. There was the steering coxswain, who had simply to do what his name implies, and there was the height coxswain, who was really the more important functionary of the two in a way, in that he had the elevator control, which was just like the steering wheel, but mounted in the fore and aft plane instead of being in the transverse plane which the steering wheel is in. He has to control the height by working up and down on his elevator wheel, and he also had to ensure that the balloon or the fabric of the envelope was kept in shape by lowering or raising the blower pipes behind each of the two propellers aft. The ship had two propellers in abreast, let's say one on the starboard side, one on the port side. As regards the trim, he was responsible for checking the trim, but it would be the first officer who would look after and have the word to say about using water ballast. Water ballast was therefore one of the minor duties of the first officer, who would be with the captain in the section of the body behind the two coxswains. The captain would be there only to give orders. He wasn't an executive functionary. He didn't have anything to control manually. And the first officer, all he had to control manually was his chart table, his chart instruments, because he also was the navigator. And he would look after the water ballast, and he would decide on the routine of the crew and reliefs. You see, we carried these extra men. I better go right aft now to the engine control car, which was the separate car, with two engines abreast, two Rolls-Royce Eagle engines, mounted in gantries immediately behind, immediately in front of their own propellers. They were driven to a reduction gear onto these two big propellers, which were fairly close under the envelope. The other man that I haven't mentioned in the crew, who was in a separate compartment in the forward part of the body, that is, in the control car, was the wireless operator, and he had a little segment curtained off with fabric in which all his wireless instruments were and where he could operate in relative peace and in relative quiet.
You haven't mentioned the engineers.
Oh, well, in that, yes, I'm sorry, I took you aft to the engines, but I forgot to mention that between the two engines was the engine control car, which was a more or less streamlined parallel body containing all the instruments and controls for the engines. And that also had two engineers in it. One would be a chief petty officer or perhaps a warrant officer, and the other would be junior to him. One would nominally be looking after the starboard engine and the other after the port engine, but either of them could be off duty and perhaps resting in the forward car, the control car, not the engine control car, but in the main car, And because we were apt to stay out for as much as 24 hours at a time. In fact, the maximum duration of a North Sea flight was, 56 hours for North Sea and about 75 hours for rigid.
With this physical separation between crews, between the crew members, which was quite different from the coastals and the SS, how did you manage about communication one with another?
It was difficult. We had a voice pipe to talk to the engineers, but there was such a din in the engine car that you really couldn't hear very much. So they would have to come, one of them would have to come forward if he wanted to communicate and tell us any good news or bad news about the engine or anything they might have seen. One was in personal contact with the wireless operator by going and talking to him in his little cubbyhole, and one was also in personal contact with the two coxswains. And naturally, the captain and the first officer were close together, either sitting down or standing up or meandering about in the small space available. There was a factor of isolation in a way, in that it was a trouble to communicate, and you couldn't actually see what each other was doing. So you did get a bit out of touch. We could see what the coxswains were doing all right, but you couldn't see whether the wireless operator was asleep or not unless you went to have a look. And nor could you see whether the engineers were having any trouble or not unless you could get them to hear down the voice pipe and get them to tell you what was going wrong, if anything.
One of the other problems you've mentioned as applying to the North Sea types was the difficulty of obtaining water for the engine cooling. Why was that such a problem?
Yes, I think I may have confused you a little bit about that. The engines were water-cooled engines, and they had radiators which were filled up before you left, they also were exposed to the air and could be a little bit shielded from the slipstream in case of very cold air. But on the whole, you started off with a certain amount of water in your circulating system, and you finished up with that same amount of water if it didn't boil in the meantime. But if you were running continuously at full speed, which we never did in the ordinary way, eventually the engine could overheat and could boil because the cooling wasn't adequate in the radiators that were provided. It was aeroplane radiators that were provided, as you understand, and they didn't, in an airship, they wouldn't go through the air fast enough to prevent the engine from boiling if it was running flat out for a length of time. So what one had to do on a particular occasion of the flight, which I will describe in a moment or two, and I hadn't heard of it happening on any other flight, was we had to use the water ballast in the control car, that's the forward control car, and transport it in more or less droplets or in cupfuls, in drinking mugs full, from that position where the water ballast was in the forward tank, in the forward car, to the after car, which was only connected by a fabric walking way. And then the engineer would have to tip up his cup of water into the radiator cap in the slipstream. And this was a very difficult and tricky operation. Moreover, it wasn't possible to walk from one end of the control car to the after end where it connected with the engine car because this was a braced fuselage construction, a braced girder construction, and you had to get on all fours or lie down to get underneath the bracing wires. So you can imagine that when we did, in fact, use water ballast to replace boiled away water in the engines, it was an unrehearsed operation with previously unused equipment for the purpose, done in a very precarious manner in the middle of the night. And so it was quite an operation, which in fact was successful, but very laborious.
I take it from what you say that physical movement around the North Sea type airship was less than straightforward.
Oh, yes, very much so. You were all right to, I mean, you could stand up and just move about a bit in the compartment in which you were. But if you wanted to get from one compartment to the other, you had to get on all fours or lie down pretty well and ooze yourself through underneath the bracing wires, because each transverse section, each girder frame, was braced with bracing wires to give lateral stability against the shearing or collapsing of those light structures.
At any point in such in this wriggling or crawling process, would you have been physically outside of the various compartments?
No. You were, all this was under cover, under fabric cover. The deck was quite walkable on all the area that you used, but the deck beyond the area that was being used for control was only partly covered with a narrow walking way, and the rest was fabric. If you put your foot through that, or if you tried to walk on that, you would just fall through. So that it was really rather a difficult operation to manoeuvre yourself about from one car to the other. It was possible, but it wasn't really initially designed to be so.
After you'd taken over the NS5, North Sea Airship 5, at King's North, you were scheduled to go to East Fortune for operational duties, but the journey to East Fortune, I believe, resulted in a disaster. Could you describe that episode for me?
Well, we flew from King's North to Howden on the day after we had done an initial trial flight to find out that everything was working all right. Then it happened that the next day was quite a good day, quite pleasant, sunny weather, and we had a straightforward flight to Howden, stayed the night there, and went on the following morning on a good weather report. There was a depression rather remote from the British Isles in the North Sea, and the forecast was good. It was quite satisfactory. In fact, there was an oversight in this, or at least an ignorance meteorologically, in that it wasn't foreseen that a secondary depression would form, which would set up gale force conditions in the area that we were approaching. And in fact, a depression, a very deep secondary depression, passed over East Fortune just after we should have finally got there that evening in the dusk. Well, normally we should have been able to get from Howden to East Fortune in just 2 or 3 hours, or about 3 or 4 hours. Had there been a southwesterly wind or a southerly wind, we would have been there by lunchtime. But in fact, we began to confront headwinds soon after we had taken off, and these became stronger and steeper, and the clouds came lower, and we were in pretty heavy rain and adverse conditions from the time we crossed the border north of Newcastle. Soon after that, we sighted a sister ship, the NS3, I think it was, captained by a friend of mine called Milne. He was on the ground, tethered. Whether he'd had engine breakdown or boiling trouble or whatever it was, we didn't know. We were not in touch by radio, but we were just able to wave to them. They were obviously having difficulties, though we couldn't see what they were. But later that night, or that evening, the ship buffeted about and bumped up and down so much that she was wrecked on the ground. We didn't see that. But we went on our way towards East Fortune with increasingly strong winds. And it may be, had we had advices otherwise, we might have turned tail and gone back to Howden. But that didn't really occur to us. We thought we'd get there all right. We were optimistic and we were making headway. What we weren't aware of is that there was increasing overheating in the engines, and the water was in fact being boiled away. We had no report of this from the engineers, but over the last stretch, when we were going from the region of Dunbar to East Fortune, which is south of North Berwick, we were happened to be going along a road at about 60 feet up, quite low down to get the minimum wind that we could. It was a very strong headwind, and we were overtaken by a Ponian trap. So you can imagine that we weren't making very fast headway. When we got within about half a mile of the boundary of East Fortune, we could see the landing party in the dusk waiting for us. Our engines had been going at full speed for about an hour and a half. At that point, when we were just about to cross the boundary, one engine stopped and we began to go astern, and a moment or two later the other engine stopped, and so we became a free balloon and rapidly were drifting backwards and drifting in a southeasterly direction. And when we crossed over St. Abb's Head, or that region, although it was dark by then, we were soon out to sea as a free balloon. So naturally then, water ballast became a very important factor in the business, and one had to conserve one's gas and one's water ballast and not use ballast unless you simply had to. Well, we did have to in the end, because while we were in the operation of slowly passing aft cups of water from our water ballast, we actually hit the sea because we were heavy at the time. The ship had cooled down in the night, and so we released a bit more water ballast than we really intended to, and went up safely out of the water. And already we had got one engine started again, and it wasn't long before we had the other engine started again. And by that time, the speed of the wind seemed to have abated a little bit, and we crept back over the coast. One could see the breakers, but you couldn't really see the land. But I knew from that afternoon, where we had seen a big airfield under construction with army supervision and people